The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I call this the Empowerment Hour. I can promise you, no matter where you're listening in the world, no matter what your station in life, no matter what your age or background, you will receive information and insight you did not have before, which will allow you, if you choose, to make better choices. Today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Vincent Bugliosi, A Case Against Believing and A Case for Believing in God, Placing the God of Literature, Theism, Atheism on the Stand. Who is Vincent? He is one of the nation's preeminent prosecuting attorneys and a multi-bestselling author. He's best known for having prosecuted Charlie Manson and the other defendants against the Tate-LaBianca murders. So we're going to ask him today, for those who believe absolutely and those who don't believe at all, let's see what the evidence is. Also, a special commentary today from one of our listeners. And then I'd like for you to respond to this. This is our issue of the day. This was from a young man, Jeremy Stillman, who came looking for work. As I'm hiring many different people in many different areas, including frontline producers for some of our documentaries, research editors who have a background of researching information over the internet and doing brief synopsis. And I asked him, he's 24-year-old, I said, if you were to give a message to your generation about what they're doing wrong and what they need to do right, what would it be? I'll read verbatim his comments. I would like your thoughts. And anyone else who would like to share their thoughts on this generation, please send your criticisms or comments to askgary@garynoll.com. I believe we should open an entire dialogue of what it means to be at different generations, what our values are, how we look at life, how we look at each other, and why some individuals seem to be stuck. We have a lot to share, including a comment from Dr. Paul King to a Dr. Gail DeLong, based upon a paper on the association between autism and childhood vaccines. This was in the Journal of Toxicological and Environmental Health, and it's a brilliant analysis. So for all of the parents in this audience who believe that their children were normal until they received vaccines and then no longer were normal, Dr. King gives us a really good insight as to why that happens and why science has been in denial, actually manipulating data to come up with a no result, meaning just like the cell phone companies. Oh, that doesn't make a connection. Oh, overheating the chromosomes doesn't prove anything. Oh, those scans of the brain after someone's been on a cell phone for only 120 seconds, 2 minutes, means nothing. There's no correlation until there was, with an epidemic incidence coming at us of brain cancer. So Dr. King is letting you know you were right, the doctors were wrong. You were right, the scientists were wrong. You were right, the FDA, the CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics, all the presidents of the United States for the last 30 years, all the top scientists in America, all were wrong. And unfortunately, the media that represents the official view only, they were also complicit in this being wrong. We will share with you today Dr. Paul King's response. It is extremely brilliant. Well, let's go to the latest in health and healing and nutrition. As you all know, any time there's a major environmental disaster, there are consequences not just immediately to the environment, to the air, to the water, to the creatures around it, but to human beings. Even if there's not an environmental disaster. For example, we've seen that those people working in fields where DDT or other pesticides are sprayed, they have a higher instance of miscarriage and stillbirth and birth defects. We also have higher instance of leukemia in the children and in ulcers that bleed and do not heal in the workers that are exposed with their legs and hands and forearms when they're harvesting crops like strawberries or lettuces. For decades, this was denied. Then one man came along who challenged it. He stood up, he organized, he fought back, Cesar Chavez. And as a result, for the first time, there was acknowledgement at least that yes, what you spray on a food can impact in a negative way the people. And hence the whole area of environmental sensitivity and chemical illness began to be taken seriously. Then comes the Gulf spill. If you go back to the Gulf spill and the programs we did, which are still archived, you will hear me saying that our biggest tragedy will not come from what happens in the Gulf. That will recycle itself. A generation of fish and crustaceans and others, plant life will die because of pollution, but another group will be born in their place. The biggest problem will be those people, about 6 million people living within, let's say, 200 miles of the Gulf. That means up in the panhandle of Florida, Panama City, Tallahassee, going straight across Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. Unfortunately, I also said that they will do everything possible to try to say there is no cause and effect. There's no association. Your sickness, your illnesses have nothing to do with the chemicals that were used in the Gulf or the oil from that. Here is the latest. This is from Common Dreams. It's from Ricky Ott. It says, lots of inconvenient truths. Chemical illnesses are epidemic in the wake of the British Petroleum blowout. Quote, recently Kenneth Feinberg, the lawyer overseeing the $20 billion Gulf Coast claims facility to make it right for people harmed by the British Petroleum oil blowout disaster, told a Louisiana House and Senate committee, quote, that he had not seen any claims or any scientific evidence linking British Petroleum's oil and dispersant release to chemical illnesses. Feinberg also stated that chemical illnesses take years to show up, conveniently well after his tenure with the compensation fund. Now, instead of tossing the media a juicy bone, Feinberg tossed a red herring. He is wrong at worst, or intentionally misleading at best, on all points. The whole process of determining the relationship between an illness and exposure is difficult for people to be compensated for medical claims or even raise illness claims, while making it easy to release claims and rights to future medical care and benefits from chemical illnesses or other medically proven illnesses related to British Petroleum blowout. In fact, the process is so blatantly egregious in terms of protecting corporate liability at the expense of human rights and health that a bill was introduced in the Louisiana State Legislature specifically targeting the British Petroleum oil disaster to declare such, quote, contractual releases are invalid against public policy and the release of claims of future medical care and related benefits null and void. Why? In lay language, it means that even though 130,000 people have filed claims, the legislature has been bought in Louisiana. That's not unusual. It's always been bought, not only from Huey Long, but everyone since. And so British Petroleum and the polluters win. The people who will now live with illnesses are the victims. My suggestion, move. You will be living with that deadly legacy for a long time, just like we learned from Love Canal, upstate New York. Even if the immediate disaster is passed, chemicals don't just go away. They stay in the soil, and as it rains, as it dries, they come back up through the soil, and you breathe them in. You're in contact with them. They're in the fish. nobody should be eating any fish, any crustaceans, any oysters, lobsters, sea scallops from the Gulf at all. And the fact that they'll claim that it's safe, don't trust them. It's not. Separately, I mentioned yesterday, new research on why blueberries are important. This is a separate article in Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. And it shows that blueberries can help lower cholesterol level, and blueberry juice or blueberry powder, very good for you in this study, which was done at the Western Regional Research Center. So I'm suggesting one full serving of blueberry a day. Now, not everybody can get blueberries. They're not available 12 months a year because they're seasonal. But you can always get blueberry concentrate. Go into any health food store and or food co-op and ask for blueberry concentrate. That's where they've taken the blueberry juice and they've wicked off or evaporated about 70% of the water. So it's a more concentrated. Now, about 3 tablespoons of concentrate is equivalent to an entire serving of blueberries. That's easy to do. It also helps your eyes, helps your immune system, and helps the epithelial tissue in the lining of your arteries, therefore softening the arteries. A really good article in a major peer-reviewed journal, as reported in Science Daily, says the following. Severe deficiency of vitamins and minerals required for life and is relatively uncommon in developed nations, but modest deficiencies is very common and often not taken seriously. A new research published shows, however, this is changing, and that the older you get, the more likely you are to be deficient. What they weren't doing, they were taking vitamin levels of younger people and pregnant women, who tend to be younger, but not of older people. As a result, most older people are vitamin deficient. They're not taking their supplements. Vitamin C, vitamin D, calcium and magnesium, zinc, the very minerals they need for strong bones, a healthy immune system, and to slow down the ravages of aging. So my suggestion is that everyone over the age of 35 should have a consultation with a qualified nutritionist, certified nutritionist, to determine, do you have adequate vitamins in your body to carry on all your biological processes? Because there's a high probability you don't. And if you have Helicobacter, which is a bacterium in the stomach, people think it's isolated. It's not. Now they're showing that it increases the severity and duration and frequency of migraine headaches. This is from the Medical News Today and research done at this Isfahan University of Medical Sciences in Iran. It says that there is a definite association between the Helicobacter and migraines. And they studied 3,200 individuals. They looked at all the literature. So here's my suggestion. If you have gastric reflux, if you have something that feels like ulcers, if you have distension in the stomach and gas, do a simple gastrological check. Have your stomach checked, your esophagus checked. And if you do have this bacterium, there are easy ways of dealing with it other than antibiotics. Vitamin C and quercetin, caprylic acid from grapefruit seed extract, garlic, cayenne, all of these together along with olive leaf extract have been shown to kill the Helicobacter in a natural way and therefore turn off not only the bacteria and the problems of digestion but also migraines. From a major publication, genetically engineered food alters our digestive system. This is the latest on this, and it says from the Alliance for Natural Health, genetically engineered organisms actually become part of the bacteria in our digestive tracts and produce continuously inside of us. But the USDA now wants to remove all controls over genetically modified corn and cotton. There are no human clinical trials on genetically engineered foods. The only published human feeding experiment revealed that genetically modified ingredients inserted into genetically modified soy transfers into the DNA of bacteria living inside our intestines and continues to function. So even after we stop eating genetically modified foods, we may still have the genetically modified proteins produced continuously inside of us. As the Institute of Responsible Technology has noted, the genetic engineering process creates massive collateral damage, causing mutations in hundreds or thousands of locations throughout the plant's DNA. Natural genes can be deleted or permanently turned on or off, and hundreds may change their behavior. So what does this mean in lay language? It means that once you eat something that's genetically engineered, you cannot control, and there is no science to show what will happen when that genetically engineered material starts changing the nature of your own genes in your body. That's dangerous. I don't want anything interfering in the natural bacteria in my system. That's why healthy organic probiotics replenish the good bacteria with even more good bacteria and keep the bad bacteria at bay. Putting genetically modified foods in can harm our bacteria. And finally, you've seen the ads, I'm sure, about the guys saying we have so much oil locked in the sands of Canada up in Alberta, and we have some great new technologies that are really clean and safe to get that oil out of there. Well, of course, most people are not aware that the number one supplier of oil to the United States is Canada and then Mexico, not Saudi Arabia. Here's what they're not telling you, and I'll be doing a whole series of original in-depth investigative reports on this. The greenhouse gas emissions from the tar sands are on the rise, but try finding that in Canada's official report to the UN. Canada is trying to hide Alberta tar sands carbon emissions and all the toxins that go into the environment and how they're destroying entire forests. They're destroying forests as large in Canada as most of the forests in New York State. So they are just leveling these forests, leaving massive pollution behind. And they want to take that tar sand, they want to make that into a form of oil and send that down to Texas with a pipeline that runs right across pristine areas of the United States. We shouldn't allow that to happen. Let me quote a report from Suzanne Goldenberg from Common Dreams. Quote, "Barely a day goes by, it seems, when someone from Stephen Harper's government is not touting the benefits of the Alberta tar sands. But when it came to counting up the carbon emissions produced by the tar sands, big and growing bigger, a strange amnesia seems to have taken hold. The Canadian government admitted this week that it deliberately left out data indicating a 20% rise in emissions from the Alberta tar sands when it submitted its annual inventory to the United Nations. The deliberate exclusion does not amount to an attempt to deceive the UN about Canada's total emissions. Emissions from the tar sands were incorporated in the overall tally in the report, but it does suggest that the government is anxious to obscure the source of its fastest-growing source of climate pollution, the Alberta tar sands. So I'm suggesting we should not encourage or accept a pipeline going clear across the United States from north to south, that if it broke, it would cause massive pollution. But I'll give more detail on that coming up. I'm Gary Nall. We have a lot to share today. Before we go to our first break, let me read this comment and open up our phones for a bit for you to call in and share your points of view on this issue, please. I'm quoting from Jeremy Stillman. "A wake-up call to my generation. When I take a good look at those in my age group, I see a generation defined by disengagement. We are disengaged from ourselves and from each other. We are disengaged from the institutions that govern us, and we are disengaged from the very planet that gives us life. We have proven ourselves adept at retreating into a virtual world of utter insignificance. We thoughtlessly become mirrored in a swamp of social media whose contents, by and large, range from the trivial to the vile. We choose to waste hours a day participating in the egomaniacal orgies of Facebook and Twitter. Our preoccupation with informing our cyber friends about pressing issues like how we ran out of shampoo this morning or found an extra pickle on our sandwich does nothing but foster a culture of narcissism and takes away from time that could be spent engaging in meaningful dialogue with an actual human being. Not to be outdone by our online personas, we skillfully manage to distance ourselves during our face-to-face altercations. After a long work week, we meet up and reach for some alcohol or drugs, looking to get wasted and stoned. We drink and smoke and end up presenting to the world a shallow and base version of ourselves. We wake up feeling terrible, have a few laughs over the mind-numbing debauchery that ensued, and get ready to go out and do it all over again. We never consider the physical, mental, and emotional toll this behavior is on us and our relationships with others. Why should we? We're too focused on the really important stuff happening around the world, like Kim Kardashian's new designer purse, or the square score, or the box score for the not last night's big game. We're more concerned with voting for an American idol than voting for a congressperson who might actually give a damn about preserving our civil liberties. We hang on to every asinine utterance that comes out of Lady Gaga's mouth, yet we won't listen to the cries of millions of our own citizens, now living in poverty due to the crafty efforts of Wall Street bankers. We excitedly run to the store to pick up the newest video games simulating the atrocities of war, yet we turn a blind eye to the wholesale annihilation of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians at the hands of our taxpayer-funded military-industrial complex overseas. And while we're at the first ones to pay lip service to the going green and saving the environment, the fact is that we remain largely ignorant and apathetic when it comes to our incredibly wasteful culture and its devastating global consequences. But that stuff is so depressing. How could we change all that? That would require effort. That would require focus and engagement with reality. This is something that our generation is capable of. But time is running out for us to sign off of Facebook and dare to take a critical look at the state of this country and the world. As soon as we wake up to the reality of our lives and the world around us, we can begin to change it for the better. So toss away those shots of alcohol, shut off your iPod, and connect with the extraordinary power of the human spirit that lies within. It's time to engage. End quote, Jeremy Stillman, who's applied for work here. I really appreciate that, Jeremy. It shows a real consciousness, even if it's painful, to acknowledge what you see in a mirror when looking at your entire generation. We need more than the exceptions talking back to that mirror. People in this audience, please give us a call now on this issue. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. We're video streaming live and broadcasting live from our studio in New York City. Back in a moment with your responses. And a happy birthday to the person who you heard in that music there. He is a creator, Les Paul. Les Paul passed away about a year and a half ago. His music was an inspiration to a whole lot of people over a long period of time. We'll be taking your calls in a moment here, and I always appreciate a chance to hear your points of view. My guest coming up in about 20 minutes now will be Vincent Bugliosi, and we're going to talk about the case for and the case against believing in God, and placing the God of literature, theism, and atheism on the stand. I think it'll be an interesting discussion. Let's say hello to Eddie from Queens. Eddie, you're on the air.
Harry, how are you?
Doing great, thank you.
I do very much enjoy your subjects on vitamins and health and those issues. However, I would like to speak maybe from a different segment of the population, one that's sort of like apathetic to things that are going on in the world. For example, I'm 50 years old. I'm in pesticides, pesticide technician, I have my physical comforts met. My ideologies of changing the world are long gone. And that's I might be wrong. Hello?
I'm listening.
Yeah, I might be wrong, and I might be taking like a bad outlook on these things, but I mean, we're here also. The youthful desires and zeal have long ago left. I'm just trying to basically coast in life now. I'm 50. I'm in relatively good health. I won't be able to make any kind of a difference, so I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong in being apathetic. But
okay, let's Eddie, first of all,
yes, sir.
I appreciate you calling in and sharing your point of view. It's not about your position being wrong. Let's just refocus it for a moment, and I'm going to ask you, if I share a point of view, just step away from yourself and see if you can appreciate the point of view. If you can, good. If you can, it's all right. All right? It's not a criticism of you or your belief, Eddie.
Okay.
And just imagine every day waking up, and it depends upon where you wake up and what the circumstances of that awakening allow you to see. For example, if you're waking up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan today, let's say you live at 89th Street and Weston Avenue, where one of my friends lives, and he lives on the top floor. He has a whole floor to himself. He's 72 years of age. Had dinner with him last night. He's depressed. He's cynical. He's angry. But he masks his anger in perpetual sarcasm. Everything is sarcastic. It doesn't mean that he doesn't want to see the world in a better place, but after 72 years and being a leading activist and a leading person and a very progressive person and trying to get change done, he just hasn't seen the benefits. In other words, he wakes up one day after all that effort and it's all back to where it started, even worse.
Yes.
Now, he wants to give up. He doesn't, like he said last night, really, Gary, you know, if something bad happens, I don't care. And I said, okay, that's only because that's how you've put your mind. Those old tapes of, if I can't handle it, if it's too big for me, if it's overwhelming, if I don't have the resources, then I just might as well let this tsunami hit me. I'm suggesting a different approach. I'm suggesting before we become cynical or apathetic and withdraw our energy, before we go into that, let me just hang out where it's comfortable and coast, realize that every single day there are hundreds of millions of individuals in this world who have changed their point of view. They were apathetic. They were frustrated and angry because they didn't see that what they were doing were making a difference. So then they changed how they were doing something. Instead of talking to those people who don't care about the message, aren't going to change. Don't tell me about this solar flares. I don't care about solar flares. Don't tell me about, you know, there are people starving in America. I could care less. I got food on my table. I can go down. That's their tough luck. You know, and Glenn Beck is with me on that. You know, we if you're too damn lazy to work, then you shouldn't get welfare. All right, that's their point of view. Well, instead of trying to change their mind, that we should care at a spiritual level about those people who are being thrown out of their homes and fighting on their behalf if they can't fight. Wouldn't you want someone, if you were being beaten up on the street and mugged, wouldn't you want someone to jump in there and try to help you to stop that from happening?
Oh, yes, yes, I would.
Okay.
Yes, I would.
So if you had someone attacking you, you would hope that there would be a person who had the courage to come forward and say, I'm going to help you. You're a stranger. I may get hurt myself, but I can't let this injustice get by me. I got to do something. Or you become the person say, thank God it's not me being beaten. Let's get away from here. We didn't see it. We're not going to tell anything. You know, let's get away. And so we shut ourselves down from what's happening to anyone else and only focus upon our own reality. And then our own reality has to be even further closed down, because if we challenge our reality, it means we're challenging the level of acceptance of our incompleteness, our incapability to change. So then our comfort, even with suffering, we can develop comfort. You can lay on a bed of nails until the day comes when you're no longer sleeping in discomfort. You've adapted to it. You can adapt to a bad relationship. You can adapt to high degrees of temperature. You can adapt to cold. You can adapt to poverty. You can adapt to anything. But that doesn't mean you should adapt. In my mindset, we should accept that we have been given a challenge, but don't adapt to it. Transfer the energy from adaptation to transformation.
Now you're right, Gary.
Now,
you're right.
Hold on, Eddie. I just want to share this other thought with you, and then you can
please
respond. So now that means I have to go to a place I've never been to develop skills I've never been given. I have to accept that in every equation I have to build in the worst-case scenario. So what happens if I do something and it doesn't work? Can I emotionally and spiritually, intellectually and creatively accept that not everything in life is going to work? Can I accept that some people I shouldn't have in my life and have to say goodbye to? Can I accept that some things I will do better than others, but if I only do the things in life I feel comfortable with, if I only do things that I've mastered, I've stopped growing. I'm no longer creating solutions. I'm no longer transforming. I am getting lazy. In that lazy gliding, then all I do is glide in a circle around a ring till I keep coming back to myself. The world is not a better place. My neighbors are not a better place. My family's not better off. I'm not better off. I've done nothing because I've allowed the conditioned tapes in my brain to tell me I'm too old, too poor, too something. The circumstances are so bad I can't change, and therefore I reinforce that because my DNA, according to a brand new study just out today, our DNA, in fact, I've got it right in my hands here. I was going to report on it. Let me just cite this. This is from Quantum Pranks, Economics and Esoteria for a New Paradigm. And it says, DNA can be influenced and reprogrammed by words and frequencies, which means, and this is done by some brilliant scientists on DNA discoveries, that what you think your actual DNA becomes. And therefore,
very interesting.
So if I think, oh my God, I can't do this race, I can't do this race, you won't do well in the race. But if I say, I'm going to fly like an eagle, I'm going to soar like a gazelle, your DNA immediately begins to change to provide you with the genetic reality to balance your emotional reality.
Well, very interesting. Very
right?
interesting. And I thank you. Listening to this, Gary, was one of the high points of the day. In a day of routine, monotony, I really greatly appreciate you taking my time to listen, you know, to mention what I, you know, said and to listen to what you have to say. Thank you very much. If there's a better use of radio, I fail to see it, you know, than having your program and to listening to these kind of things.
Thank you, Eddie.
I can only thank you very much, and I wish you all the very best in your life.
Okay, and remember, Eddie, stop before you put a thought in your mind and ask yourself, what is the likely outcome of this thought? Will it be a thought that is positive with a positive outcome or negative with a negative outcome? Because, Eddie, if you put a negative thought in your mind, a helpless thought, a victim thought, then your DNA will actually make you a victim. If you put a positive thought, then you have a chance to liberate yourself. At some point, we all as a society have to push against the prison cell, the cultural cell, the religious cell, the political cell, the economic cell, the bias cell, the gender cell, all of the cell doors that keep us in prison. We must have the strength of character to push against them, and lo and behold, the damn door opens. Then do we have the courage to step outside and become free? If we do, then we are in the process of transformation. That's what I try to do each day. Focus upon the illusion of being a prisoner to our culture versus the power of faith in breaking free. Thank you. Let's say hello to Greg from the Bronx. Hi, Greg. Greg, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that letter you just read.
Please.
You know, I'm retired. I'm 68. You know, I didn't know what to do with myself, so I thought I would take some classes at Lehman College to try to find myself in music. I'm a musician. And what I learned was that the university there is just so locked into routine that they don't really think. And the quality of students were so low that I just dropped out. I couldn't take it, you know. And
okay, a simple suggestion, Craig. Try this visualization today, would you, if I share it with you?
What?
I'm going to give you a simple visualization. Will you try it today?
Okay.
Okay. Visualize yourself as a sea of water.
Okay.
And you're hitting a rock.
Right.
What are you going to do when you hit the rock?
When I hit the rock, what am I going to do?
Yeah, what are you going to do when water hits a rock?
It just splashes away.
No. That's a conditioned response. That means the rock has a greater capacity to determine the flow of energy than the human spirit. You're going to go around that rock. So you're going to visualize today going around every obstacle. If one college is not in the same rhythm of need as you have, then find one that is. There's plenty of online educational programs that are more conducive to people who are from a different generation and are more patient and more creative. So don't let one experience determine your life. It's just an experience, and let it go, and you and your capacity for learning are greater than some limitations. So don't let a limitation happen, okay?
Well, Gary, what I did learn was what I didn't like about it. I thought that was a very good learning experience.
As long as you're right. You're right. We all have to learn what we don't like and what we won't accept. That's a very powerful lesson. But that only is the first step in freedom. Freedom has two steps. The first step is freedom from a restrictive belief. But the second step is what engages you in a positive, powerful, and happy life. Freedom for something that is greater than what you were against. Ultimately, your fulfillment in life comes from what you're for, not what you're against. Too many activists, too many people. If you want to see one of the most depressing environments in the world, go to a meeting of the left. Want to see one of the most powerfully positive groups? Go to a meeting on the right. Now, why would the right be so positive and the left so negative? Why would the right not throw any of their senators, including the senator from Louisiana, who was caught with a prostitute, and yet no one asked for his resignation, and yet on the left, they want Wiener's resignation?
They're all hypocrites.
Of course they're all hypocrites, but on the left, everything comes from what they don't like, and on the right, it's because they believe they want to put something in power that changes, even if they're wrong on what they want to do, which they frequently are. So you want to be depressed? Hang around a non-commercial radio station for a day. And we're still go to one of their meetings. My God, you'd think you were in the 1930s in a communist, meeting.
Well, find that the right are, they attack people, they kill people, they're dominating people.
I understand. And you mean the left didn't? Gee whiz, you mean Clinton didn't allow the deaths in Rwanda, and Clinton didn't allow the deaths and encourage the death in Yugoslavia and Bosnia? And you mean there wasn't the no-fly zone and the 500, half a million children dead in Iraq? Just be careful what you say before you stop and think, because once again, that's aligning yourself, your beliefs, your values, and your reality to an existing paradigm. And that's one of the reasons that today we have 45% of the American population are independent, because they see that both of these sides, right and left, are so wrong on any of the solutions they try to provide us. It takes a more measured, nuanced, and proactive way of looking for solutions, neither of which are they doing. But I thank you very much, Greg, for calling in, and all the best to you. Back in a moment with my guest and your questions in studio. Please stay with us.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember
the music of Les Paul. I'm Gary Knoll in our studio in New York City. Tomorrow, what I didn't get to today, I will. I'm going to have a commentary on the great land grab, India's war on farmers, and what that means to us. Also, millions are being displaced by natural disasters, and a call out to all the people who listen to this program from Australia who believe you're in a good place. You're not. You'll find out why tomorrow. I'm going to be predicting what's going to happen to Australia based upon the latest science and of climate on all the major cities, Perth and Brisbane and Sydney. They're all on the water, what that means. Also, tomorrow, the lack of relationships and education are the top list of common American regrets. Here's the good news. We can do something about it. So even the crisis that many people hated and really are bad is actually a way for many people to engage in things they never did in their life because they're forced to, and I'll get into that tomorrow also. Also, for those of you who are Latino and may not speak fluent English, we now have hired a person named Carmen in our office who speaks, oh, she's Latino, and fluent Spanish. So now you have someone you can speak to in Spanish by speaking with Carmen in our office. And just a few program announcements before we go to our next topics. Tomorrow evening, I'll be doing our workshop on sustainability. And it's not apocalyptic. It's a whole arc. And on the arc could be those people who want to be able to bring more of a organic and holistic lifestyle into wherever they live. You could live in an apartment or a house in Brooklyn and still be doing homesteading projects. You could do something not because of anything in the weather, but because of wanting to get back to something that was better that you found earlier in life. Maybe when you're a teenager in your 20s and you went to the country and you thought, boy, I'd love to get into the country. Well, I'm going to talk about that. I'm also going to talk about the latest on environmental issues. All that is tomorrow. And you can watch it over the internet by going to GaryNoll.com. We're filled up in studio. And then at 8:30, my lecture on Where's My Life, Dude? And I'm going to deal with careers for younger people and all the major issues that they're faced with and show how they've been dealing with them and what I believe would be a more positive and constructive way. And most importantly, on Saturday at 1 o'clock, we'll be doing our one and only, through the summer, every 2 weeks, health support group. This is for completely healthy people who want to get healthier and anyone else who wants to use lifestyle and behavior modification to improve your state of health. The number for those, if you want to join us, is 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Now let's go to our guest who is standing by, because he has to leave shortly. So let's say hello to Vincent Bugliosi. I've given you his background already earlier in the program. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
Well, happy to be on the show, Gary. I heard you say I have to get going, but we can certainly, if you have the time, we can go up to a half hour. Happy to be on the show.
Thank you. I'd like to begin first with a look at the religious landscape across America today, with its increasingly turning more mythological than intelligent and rational. Now, in the past week, we have seen GOP Tea Party Michelle Bachmann tell Iowa Public Television that God has told her to run for the presidency of 2012, just as God told her to run for Congress, and how the divinity in heaven told Bush and Sarah Palin in the past, and seeing fully where these epiphanies have led to. And yet, we also hear people like Blankenfeld from Goldman Sachs saying he's doing God's work at Goldman Sachs, and his firm is investigated and indicted on illegal activities with likely numerous yet-to-be-uncovered outcomes. And what this tells me, within a culture filled with superstition and biblical myth, that all it takes for someone in power to cover up wrongdoings and unethical behaviors is to evoke the name of the divine as the source of their decisions. So, before we put our Judeo-Christian divinity on the stand, I would like to first hear your views on how the current mythology of this God has eroded American society, politics, and most of all, democracy. In other words, what is the relationship between the degree of superficial religion and the degree of dysfunction in the nation?
Boy, you asked quite a question there. But the implication of your question is that this is something kind of emerging and true, and new. But it's not, as you know, Gary. I mean, if anything, we're getting away from religiosity. Not in America. We're becoming more religious here. But Europe is becoming more and more secular. But there's always been this mythology. In fact, back around the time of Jesus, there were the allegations of constant miracles. At least we don't hear that too much anymore. As far as dysfunction is concerned, I think we've already established, again, this is nothing new, and in my book I talk about things that people are not talking about, but this is nothing new at all. the connection between religion and dysfunction. There was a pretty widespread, comprehensive survey that was done in 2009 of 17 industrial nations, including, of course, the United States, to test the umbilical cord, if there was one, between religiosity and the dysfunction of a nation. It turns out that the United States was the most religious of all 17 nations. I think Ireland was two, maybe Italy was three. And also, not only the most religious, but the most dysfunctional of all 17 nations. The dysfunction was in terms of things like, divorces, abortions, murders, stuff like that, health care, longevity, all types of things. There were about 10 or 15 barometers, and it turns out the United States is the most dysfunctional of all nations, of all those 17, and yet the most religion. But is this something new, Gary, that you're suggesting? This mythology has been going back for centuries.
Okay, let's take that back, and I'm just going to share a few minutes with you, so if you would just listen to everything I have to say,
okay,
and then respond to it, because I'm a great believer in going to the core of something.
Well, that's what I do in my book, yeah.
I know. The individuals frequently cite that it's all based upon Jesus. The rapture is Jesus going to come back and take those who believe you, don't. You're going to be, drowned in hell in a fire, lake of fire. But let's take for a moment the actual proof of Jesus. What does he have in common with others? He was a superhero, meaning, think of this. He was born on the December 25th, and he was the son of a virgin. Very common. He also, he was visited by wise people on his birth. Also common. He turned water into wine. He healed the sick. He killed demons. He performed miracles. He was betrayed for silver. He sat at a communal table with his last meal. He died on a cross and he was resurrected. Now, people think, okay, that's Jesus. Fine. Okay, let's say it is Jesus. But what about Hercules and Mithras and Adonis and Tammuz and Thor, which is in the movies right now, and Osiris and Orpheus, a Krishna, a Chorus, Hermes, Dionysus, Bedru, Baldur, Bacchus, Baal, Attis. These also all were mythical figures who all had similar situations than Jesus. In fact, the very first Easter was when? It was 2400 B.C., the first celebrated Easter. I can show you multiple Christs throughout history, at least over 100. So why have we given all the credit for this one Christian being as if it's historically accurate and proven? Your thoughts?
Geez, Gary. You know, you're bringing up things, Gary, that you could talk to probably a couple million people about. And I have things in my book that you can only talk to me about. I mean, what you said is true. What do you want me to say about it? Of course it's true. Most of the Christian mythology goes back to Greek and Roman mythology, and there's all types of precedents for it. But everyone knows this, Gary. Everyone knows this. I've got things in my book that people are not talking about, Gary, and we're...
Well, then share some of that with us.
Okay. Have you had a chance to look at the book?
I'm sorry I have not been given your book yet.
Oh, my God. That's inexcusable. That's absolutely inexcusable. And maybe that's why we're talking about things that aren't in the book. Well, let me say that I'm more excited about this book, Divinity of Doubt, than any other book in my entire career. And I've had 7 New York Times bestsellers, 3 getting up to number 1. And the reason is not only that there is no more important subject than God, Gary, either a God or no God. But we're talking here about a conversation, at least when we talk about Christianity, a 2,000-year-old conversation in which it's pretty well conceded that nothing new has been brought to the table in a great number of years. And believe it or not, my book does bring many new things to the table. And if you give me a couple of minutes off the top, and then we can get into other questions.
Sure.
Please I'll go over some of the things in the book.
Fine, I'd like to hear it.
We all hear, of course, that God gives all of us free will. And if you challenge someone on it, they say, it's in the Bible. Well, it turns out that, because I checked this out very, very thoroughly, that the Bible does not say there's free will. In fact, it says the precise opposite, that there is no free will. I don't have to tell you the enormous ramifications of this. How do you explain God's punishment of evildoers if it turns out that what they did was preordained by God? They had no choice. Now, mind you, I'm not saying there's no free will. If you were to ask me, I'd say, why ask me? Why not ask my neighbor or the local grocer? I'm talking about the Bible here. Let me give you a couple very quick biblical citations, then we'll get on to the next point. Isaiah 63:17 says, Lord, why do you cause us some free will? Why do you cause us to stray from thy ways? Romans 11:32 goes so far as to say, quote, God consigns all men to disobedience. Talmudic scholars, not just for years, but for centuries, have been trying to get around, because Judaism believes so strongly in free will, Exodus 4:21, in which God tells Moses, I'm going to harden the heart of the Pharaoh, causing him to be stubborn so he will not set the people free, referring to the Israelites in Egypt, and thereby apparently justifying his imposition of the 10 plagues on the poor people of Egypt. It turns out that the immortality of the soul was a pure invention of Plato in the 4th century B.C. I traced it all the way back. That Christianity was literally forced to embrace. Why? Because without the immortality of the soul, Gary, obviously there's no life after death, and without life after death, there's no heaven and hell. And I would pose the rhetorical question, how does Christianity even survive? How does it stay alive without heaven and hell? This is what Christianity offers or threatens its followers with. One of the most startling things in the book, and in all candor, it's just one of many. I found evidence, Gary, in the New Testament, which, when read in conjunction with the Hebrew Bible, more specifically Isaiah 7:14, that proves not just beyond a reasonable doubt, but beyond all doubt, that Jesus was not born of a virgin. Now, again, I'm not saying this. I'm talking about the Bible here. And if Jesus was not born of a virgin, then he was not the Son of God. If he was not the Son of God, then the Christian doctrine that God had his Son die on the cross for our sins goes out the window too, which in effect ravages much of Christianity. Now, I would assume that a goodly number, maybe the vast majority of your audience, is finding this very difficult to believe. The only problem is that it happens to be the truth, and this is why many people reading Divinity of Doubt are saying that no one who reads this book will ever again feel the same way about God and religion. If you want me to give you the support for what I just told you about the virgin birth, I can, or we can go on to other things like atheism. I'm very harsh on atheism in the book, by the way. I view atheism as being somewhat intellectually barren, a barren philosophy whose chief prolocutors, I'm talking about people like Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins. If you read what these people say, Gary, very closely, you're going to find one non sequitur after another. To me, I have yet to find one persuasive, powerful argument for the non-existence of God. These people cannot find a non sequitur that they do not like. I do not, obviously, I don't know whether or not there's a God, but if there isn't, I do not believe that atheistic dogma leads one rationally to that conclusion. I'm an agnostic. You probably inferred that from the title of the book, The Divinity of Doubt. The theist believes, as you know, in God. The atheist does not believe. The agnostic says, I don't know. Perhaps a better definition of the word agnostic is someone who believes that the existence vis-a-vis non-existence of God is unknowable. Of course, if it's unknowable, there's no way for anyone to know. I always like to tell people that I have a rather bright person on my side. At least most people think he's kind of bright. His name is Einstein. Einstein was an agnostic. Interestingly enough, Gary, Darwin was also an agnostic. I say interestingly enough because, as you probably know, most evolutionists, not all, but most evolutionists turn out to be atheists. And yet here the founder the founder of evolution, Darwin, was a very firm agnostic. I believe that whether or not God exists is an impenetrable mystery beyond human comprehension. As Einstein put it, he said, the problem is too vast for our limited minds. I love Gertrude Stein's very clever, although non-literary, articulation of agnosticism. She said, there ain't no answer, there ain't going to be any answer, there never has been an answer, that's the answer.
Okay.
Clarence Darrow from 19...
Vincent, let me just interject here,
yeah.
All right?
Okay.
And for those of you who are listening, we'll continue this conversation over the Progressive Radio Network. First, one of the most... the only completely unforgiving sin that's listed in the Bible repeatedly is the denial of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, agnostics and atheists alike, because there is doubt, whether it's legitimate doubt or not, are then seen as no better than a secular, humanist, spiritual person, and therefore they're cast out. And let us also not forget that a lot of people believe that everything Jesus said or was said about Jesus is accurate. Jesus in Luke 19:27 said, "These enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me." Well, then you have to say, all right, I thought the Old Testament was filled with wrath and fear and violence. You mean it's also in the New Testament? And then you have to ask, how do we really come up with the notion of Jesus? And then you have to look at the Apostle Saul, who became the Apostle Paul,
right,
and near Damascus. And this was that missing gap between 33 and 70, when nothing was known about Jesus. And yet here's the man who is more than anyone else given credit for telling us about Jesus. How many words did he write? It's estimated to be over 75,000 words he wrote about Christianity. But interesting, in Paul's writing, he never once mentioned Mary, Joseph, the virgin birth, John the Baptist, Bethlehem, no miracles, no mention of trial of Jesus and his crucifixion, no mention of Pontius Pilate at all. In fact, Paul actually wrote and believed that Jesus never lived on earth. He said, if Jesus had been on earth, he would not even have been a priest, Hebrew 8:4. So what we have to understand is that either Jesus was a mythological character, a spiritual character, or a historical character, or something of that type, and yet those people who believe absolutely in that word, which are about 30 million, have enormous political power. They have enormous power within our society.
Right.
And my concern is not what a person believes. They have a right to believe anything, and I know that you accept that also. But what happens when they take the power of their belief to be the supreme power of the land and cause us to go into wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as we did in 1296 in the
right.
Crusades, as if their proclamation that Jesus is this Father, or the Son of God, and he died for us, and we're now going to show we respect that by going in and killing these heathens, make the world right for God. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, what a mistake. Your thoughts?
You said a lot of great stuff, but there's many, many points you raised. Paul did write most of the New Testament, but you're overlooking the fact that there are people, there were disciples of his who contributed to the New Testament. Matthew and John were disciples of God,
but
and,
we never
of Jesus.
We have no historical proof that Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John were anything other than allegorical figures. It was actually
it goes a little beyond that. It's not that clear cut. If you look at let's take Mark, for instance, and you read Eusebius. I don't know if you've heard of Eusebius.
Yes, I have.
He was quite a historian of early Christianity. Mark was in Rome with Peter. Peter was a disciple, and Peter was making his ministry verbally all over the Mediterranean world as far as Rome, and then, of course, he was executed, and the people prevailed upon Mark, who knew Peter very, very well, to put it in writing, what Peter had said. So there is some connection to the supposedly living Jesus, but you're right that Paul is the main person, and he never saw Jesus except in that epiphany on the way to Damascus.
But he only, in that epiphany on his way to Damascus, it was as a dream, and not right. as a historical on. He never believed Christ stepped foot on earth. If he didn't step foot on earth, then everything else we've been led to believe about Christ would be wrong.
Yeah, but there are several references in Paul, of course, to a living Jesus. There
I understand, but that was his most personal insight. Vincent, unfortunately, we're out of time here.
Yes, right.
I want people to read your book because I believe it's a very important book for them. I'm going to look forward when your publisher sends me a copy.
There's no excuse for that. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. And I thank you very much, as you have in your other books, for taking the time and scholarship to ask questions and address us in a way that allows us to challenge our own values and therefore see if we can't break down some walls and learn to expand our consciousness.
Thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate it, sir.
Vincent Bugliosi, my guest. And let us also not forget, I did not have time today to go into this, but beyond the belief in a God or a Jesus or any other of figures in history from any religion, what is the power of our own belief in the eternity of life, the completeness of life, and the magnificence of life? That is for another discussion. Have a nice day.
When the sun in the morning peeps over the hill and it kisses the roses round my windowsill, then my heart fills with gladness when I hear the trill of the birds in the treetops on Mockingbird Hill. Tra-la-la, toodity-deedy, it gives me a thrill to wake up in the morning to the mockingbird's trill. Tra-la-la,
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.